The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
So today, the section on the IRMs, the innate releasing mechanisms. If you see a statement like this, how do you respond to that? The innate releasing mechanism responds to complex stimulus configurations and triggers a behavioral response from the organism. An innate behavioral response, innately determined behavioral response. But is that true, the way it's stated? It's not a quote from Lawrence. But I've seen things like this. What's wrong with it? Where is it wrong? Yes.
Isn't it true that the IRM can't respond selectively to complex bodies?
If it's an innate releasing mechanism, it does. That's right. It doesn't respond to very complex bodies. It responds to very simple aspects of the environment. You know, when I get attacked by a hamster, I never take it personally. Why? That hamster is not responding to me as an individual at all. It's responding to some part of me, like my hand, that maybe was invading his home territory or whatever. I almost never get bit by a hamster because I can usually tell in advance what they're about to do. But once in a while, I'm not paying close attention. And it's happened. It happened to me very early on when I was a graduate student. And it made me very interesting. What was different about that animal? I had a lot of respect for him. If I were an animal in the situation he was in, I would certainly want to do what he did. I admired the animal a lot. They have very sharp teeth, by the way. But they're fun to work with. Yes?
Well, how many of the attacked by hamster bitten, or did they call the
discretion? No, they bite. And they have teeth, remember, that can go through wood. Well, they go through finger, too. The bite went right down to the bone. But it was a very clean bite. They were clean animals. I kept my animals clean, and I recovered just fine, with more respect for hamsters and the way they behave. But let's go into this a little more. I took a few things. I think it's an important point. These are examples of the simplicity of key stimuli. And Lawrence picked out some really simple ones. Many books quote Fonuxkill's tick. In fact, they often call it Fonuxkill's tick. Actually, it's just his description of what makes the female common tick bite. She responds to two things only: body temperature of around 37 degrees, which she can detect at a distance, in fact. The smell of butyric acid. Ticks can drop from a bush onto a passing mammal. And then if those two conditions are there, they will bite. Very simple, key stimuli. What are the chances that those two stimuli would be present and it wouldn't be a mammal? Well, it'd have to be some chemist from MIT, so it'd be very unlikely, right? It's gonna be a mammal, okay? That's why the simple stimuli work. Even more extreme is the female cricket's response to a courting male. She responds specifically to the pitch of his song. And if it's a different species of cricket, the males will sing at a different frequency, so she won't respond. Lawrence describes how in one study of this, they were playing that frequency through a loudspeaker, and female crickets would jump right into the loudspeaker. In other words, they're not responding to the male cricket as a being. They're responding to the stimuli, the key stimuli. and some mosquito males respond specifically to the frequency of the wing beats of the female. And since the wing beats of females of different species differ a little bit, they can discriminate that way. But those are extreme. In most cases, there's more than one key stimulus that are additive in their effects. There was an important contribution made by an MIT professor to the study of innate releasing mechanisms, which made the term mechanism took on some embodiment, because this was a study of the brain. Jerry Lethen, with his study together with Umberto Maturana, Warren McCulloch, and Bill Pitts. They published this in 1959 in the Proceedings of the Institute of Radio Engineers, a strange place for a paper on either behavior or physiology, but that's where they published it. What the frog's eye tells the frog brain. What did he study, and why is it relevant to innate releasing mechanisms? Somebody tell me? Yes?
He researched how the animal or the culture stimuli.
Okay.
Certain receptors.
What animal was it?
A frog.
And what part of the animal? I mean?
The retina.
Right. He recorded firing patterns of retinal ganglion cells or the axons of those ganglion cells. You can record the activity of those axons in the optic tectum by recording from the endings. They're the elaborate arbors of those axons you can record there. And what kind of thing did he find? Well, it depended on the layer of the tectum where he was located. He would record different populations of axons. One of them was particularly interesting because the stimuli seemed to correspond to the type of stimuli produced by a fly moving in the visual field. A little spot, dark spot on a lighter background, moving and then stopping, exactly the kind of stimulus that will elicit the orienting and then the tongue flick of the frog. He did also find other kinds of responses. Some of you must have had studies of the brain where you remember some of this. Remember any other types of responses he found in the tectum? He found one type of cell that would respond to darkening. You know, well, if some animal appears, larger thing appears over the frog, the whole sky will darken, right? And that makes the frog respond in a very different way. Now, Lepin wasn't recording the responses of the frog. He was recording the responses of the retinal ganglion cells. So he was just looking at the input side there, that what we know is the innate releasing mechanism, because these are the same stimuli that we can get specific behavioral patterns, built-in behavioral patterns from the frog. And that's why the study was so important. But not just from the standpoint of behavioral studies, it was important in the history of the field of visual physiology. And so it was one of the first studies of specific receptive field patterns in the central nervous system. The retina, of course, is part of the central nervous system. It preceded the studies of Hubel and Wiesel on the visual cortex of monkeys by some years. This is related to the simplicity of these key stimuli that we were talking about I want an example of maladaptive behavioral responses to key stimuli. These are examples that, you know, emphasize this sparseness of the information and key stimuli. The parsimony of the information, parsimony of the information carried by most key stimuli. And these are the two examples he had. Can somebody describe them? Remember, we mentioned once before the turkey's chick's response to an overhead hawk. It's very specific and it's very impressive when you see turkey chicks that have never seen anything in their lives respond to an overhead hawk. It's a very specific releasing mechanism. But what is the maladaptive response? Yes?
They have the same response to a fly on the ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. If a fly on the ceiling is moving, it can elicit the same response. Not very adaptive. It makes suddenly what seemed like this brilliant built-in behavior look stupid. You know, it's maladaptive. But on the other hand, how often is that going to occur in the natural environment of the turkey? You know, not very much. So, what about the kestrel's response to water? And this is true for other water birds too. First time they see water, they can swim, they can bathe in it, they'll preen in it, they will, you know, behave like kestrels. And it looks amazing when you see it. A bird never saw water before, and yet they're adapted. Most water birds are like this. But what's an example of a maladaptive response by the same animal? Yeah.
If you put it on a marble countertop, it's shiny.
Yeah, the shiny marble tabletop will elicit the same behavior. And they'll look really stupid because they'll be showing this behavior on the marble tabletop. So these are examples of the consequences of these key stimuli that are so simple. Lawrence talks about the transposability of key stimuli, and I want to know what he means by that. Anybody? Yes. Yeah, the absolute parameters are not fixed because they're not responding to the absolute parameters. They're responding to relationships between stimuli. Like they might respond to the upper part of a stimulus, always they might respond to the contrast, and what will make a difference is the key contrast. It will not be any set quantity. So it's like Gestalt psychology studies of the way we respond to visual shapes. The difference is that they're dealing with pretty complex shapes. Here we're dealing with pretty simple stimulus configurations. But it's like Gestalt psychology in that we're responding to relationships. He did find a couple of exceptions to that. One was that jackdaw's response to the dangling black thing. But then again, it hasn't been studied that much. It looked to Lawrence like it was not a more complex stimulus. You know. But in fact, the way the visual system, the jackdaw responds, may turn it into something simpler. He had another example in there too. What was it?
Something about a melody?
It was a spider, the male jumping spider.
It was quite interesting because this jumping spider responds to, initially he'll run towards any small black thing that's moving towards it on legs. But when it's close, then its response changes depending on how spider-like it is. You know, if it's got legs that go up above the body, like a spider's, it responds with courtship movements. And if it doesn't, the little legs underneath it, then it responds as if it's prey. So, and the stimuli seem complex. But again, that would depend on how the visual system is working. Okay, explain how the European cuckoo has evolved to exploit the properties of innate releasing mechanisms. Then we'll talk also about the white bird, which is also, does something similar. What does the cuckoo do? How does it reproduce? Somebody remember? Yes?
Can you put your energy other birds' nests so the other birds will raise their eggs?
That's right. They put their eggs in another bird's nest, and there's more than one species they'll do that to. Why does it work? Yeah.
But it's larger than normal, so it's
a supernormal
stimulus.
Yeah.
And the other birds
respond to that. That's right. The parent birds respond to the gaping of the newborn cuckoo even more strongly than they respond to their own young. Now, I think I've read different things. I thought cuckoos, in fact, could exist in a nest with other birds. But according to Lawrence in this book, they get rid of the other eggs. Yes?
I know that cowbirds are big enough, like cowbirds do the same thing, and the hatchlings hatch sooner than the actual children of the parents, and so they wind up pushing the...
So others get pushed out,
yeah.
Right?
So they're not trying to kill them, they just wind up pushing them out.
So it's quite amazing, because from the standpoint of the other species, they're being taken advantage of totally by these parasites raising somebody else's children. Why are the white birds different from the cuckoo? They do something a little bit different. They don't need supernormal stimuli for one thing. Yes?
They go to the nest. I think they're
exactly. They look so much like the birds in the other birds in the nest that the parents can't tell them apart, so the parents will raise both of them. In both cases, these are birds that lay their eggs in another bird's nest. I mean, it's quite an amazing adaptation, birds that don't take care of their own young. Yes? It's similar to that, yes, because swans will be raised by ducks. Because when they're small, they don't look as different. And then as they grow, they look more and more different. As we know from the story of the ugly duckling. Okay, now go to the same kinds of things in human behavior. And we're not talking about child rearing here. We're talking about exploitation of the properties of innate releasing mechanisms that we're born with. How does the doll industry take advantage of that? Anybody else here? Yes. That's right. They exaggerate the key stimuli that elicit, you said, parental responses. Does that elicit parental responses? You mean even in children, in boys, in men? The fact is, yes. We all have responses to the key stimuli that characterize babies. And a lot of those key stimuli are visual. They're also auditory and movement stimuli. But the doll industry takes advantage just of the visual aspects and can create these cute little things that we respond to. What are other examples of stimuli like that? What are the stimuli? You started to spell out what some of them were. And there's a nice picture in Lawrence. You should all study that picture. What does he have in that picture? He's comparing human babies with what?
Adults.
With adult animals. He's comparing with adult animals, some of which look more like babies than others, like the Pekingese. The Pekingese has got the high head and the short snout, and it makes it look cuter than a hound dog. That's why people like Pekingese as pets. And he points out that we look at the robin as cuter than other birds because it's got that, its shape is a little more like a baby. But in the human child, the human baby, newborn, it's very interesting because they have, you can spell out very clearly all these characteristics, you know, that he describes verbally there. And if you just put those in a cartoon, people respond as if it's cute. And children continue to look different from adults for many years. And women continue to look more like children than men. That's why they're cuter. Literally. I mean, it's literally true. It's characteristic of women, particularly when they're younger. What about food industry? We mentioned this once before. It's another example of exploitation of innate releasing mechanisms that are open-ended in Lawrence's terms. Open-ended meaning there's no cutoff. There's no optimal level. They just, the more is better.
Sugar and fats.
Sugar and fats, right. We were talking about it before. I don't agree that sugar is bad for you the way everybody, often you read, you're told, don't eat sugar, it's bad for you. You know, sugar is a wonderful source of energy. And one of the reasons we eat, we don't eat just for nutrition, meaning vitamins and protein and so forth. We also eat for energy. In fact, it's a major reason why we eat. And sugar is a wonderful source of energy. And anybody that does sports knows the value of sweet things for quick energy. Not artificial sweeteners, real sugar. And I know the value of that because sometimes I have to raise my blood sugar because I'm diabetic. Yes?
What do you mean about the eerie monster?
Yes, that was very interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that. What does he mean? If you exaggerate the key stimuli, the baby you're drawing will get cuter and cuter, or the doll you're making, until you exaggerate too much. If you go beyond a certain point, it suddenly turns into an eerie monster. And that's true for a number of things if we exaggerate too much. But of course, the doll industry has worked all that out long ago. Okay, now this is another important thing dealing with these key stimuli. I want you to tell me what's the difference in meaning of these terms, the releaser and key stimuli. Aren't key stimuli the releasers?
Yeah.
Not quite. Not in the way ethologists use these terms. And then I want to know how you can usually recognize releasers before you even know much about them. What is a releaser? Yes? It's not the key stimulus itself.
No, it's
the thing that gives the key stimuli. You know? Like the parent bird that has a beak with a red spot on it, the releaser is what the parent has and what the parent does, the way the parent moves, in order to present the key stimuli. So releasers often involve some movement. But when you talk about the evolution of a releaser, you're not just talking about the key stimuli, but the thing that produces the key stimuli, which are often in another animal of the same species. Okay? Not always, of course. Releasers evolve as anti-predator devices, too. Like the animals that evolved the ability to present a pair of big fake eyes that will scare another animal into thinking he's facing a predator. Even tigers respond to eyes, or just if you wear a mask, tigers like to attack from behind to an animal running from it. So if you wear a mask with prominent eyes and you put it on the back of your head, you're less likely to be attacked by a tiger. Doesn't always work though, but it works. The statistics show it's a very clear effect, and that's actually been used to protect villagers in northern India. How do we usually recognize releasers? You're walking through a forest or a field. What kinds of things would call your attention to releasers? Things, what are they usually like? For one thing, they're usually beautiful. And what a lot of things we call beautiful evolved as releasers, okay, to affect behavior. They're usually bold colors, simple in design, prominent, because their function, they evolve in order to serve, to present key stimuli to release behavioral patterns. Okay, so that's why they're fairly easy to recognize.
Question about that, coming out of the fall now, do you use the same colors or the thinking of the bright bold colors, red leaves.
Right. And there, because we're not dealing with animals, we're dealing with plant behavior, you know. I don't know if I want to call that a releaser. But we know that plants and animals interact, and the way flowers evolve, of course, is to they are releasers of the feeding behavior of bees and wasps and birds and so forth. But the colored leaves, I don't know of a function like that. If anybody can think of one, let me know. But you're right, it's a good... You wonder, how is that benefiting the tree? Does it alter animal behavior? So describe two releasers in humans. And I said they often involve movement. So give me one that involves movement, one that doesn't. Releasers. What are prominent things that people are always doing to make people feel better or to make them feel happy or to make them behave better?
Smiling.
Smiling, right. That's a releaser. Okay, it affects other people in a specific way, and that's why we do it. And of course, many other emotional expressions can be also serve as releasers. Okay, yes?
So if the smile is the releaser, then what is the key stimulus in that case?
the key stimuli you can work out, but it has involves contrast, size and shape. Actually, the key is the turned up edges of the mouth. This has been studied, you know. And the more prominent lips, you know, can emphasize that. Wearing lipstick emphasizes it even more. But the reason women wear lipstick and men don't is not just to emphasize the smile, it's to emphasize sexual differences. And it's because women that are sexually aroused will have redder lips. And it turns men on, it attracts men. And that's the reason women don't know, that's why they're putting on lipstick, but in fact, that's where it comes from. Okay. Okay, give me another releaser that doesn't involve movement like the smile. Yes? Yeah, the fat on the cheeks of a baby. They lose the fat in their cheeks later. And see, there's been many arguments about this, that it plays some role in the nursing. None of them turn out to be true when you examine them very far. It's simply the visual effect it has on adults or older people. We shouldn't just say adults because it has the same effect on older children. Okay, it makes them cuter. We behave differently towards a baby because of these and the other associated stimuli. They're releasers of parental-type behaviors.
What is the key stimulus in that?
The key stimulus is simply the prominence of the cheeks, the shape of it affects the shape of the face. The releaser in this case is the fat, the bulging fat that. See, when we talk about the evolution of a releaser, we mean the way the baby has changed. What constitutes, what produces the key stimuli? Okay. Let me hurry up and try to get through here. Mimicry usually evolves in a species in order to affect the behavior of other species. And we talked about that when we talked about parasitism, eliciting parental behavior from another species. I want you to describe cases of mimicry that has evolved to affect other members of the same species. Wolfgang Wickler studied this for a while. He described, and Lawrence includes two examples of it, the baboons and vervet monkeys. That's from Wickler's study. The mouth breeder fish were studied in Lawrence's laboratory. What was it about the mouth breeder fish? What did he evolve? What was he mimicking? Anybody? Yes.
He has shaded orange spots on his tail that look like eggs.
That's right. The female mouth breeder takes the eggs into her mouth, and he takes advantage of that, in a sense, evolution takes advantage of it, by putting the spots on the tail fin of the male. So she will follow the male trying to grab those what look like eggs, and he can release his sperm and fertilize them right in her mouth. The consequence, the reason that's so adaptive, is then if the eggs aren't, she's not having to, she's already got the eggs in her mouth, they're safe. Okay. So it's a very safe way to do it. I know it sounds a strange way to have sex, but there's a lot of interesting ways evolution has worked to get adaptive reproductive behavior. Yes?
Are they her own eggs or other
females? Generally her own eggs.
Because I know in one video that we watched that the female fish would eat other females' eggs.
They do. But here we're talking about the mouth breeder, literally the name comes from the way they collect their eggs and hatch them in the mouth. But what about baboons and vervet monkeys? This is fascinating because I've known about this for a long time because you see, when you go to zoos, you see it's so obvious that the male vervet monkey, and in baboons too, on the rump of the male, they have they're colored bulges that imitate the genitalia of the female when she's receptive. Now, why would the male evolve that? because it affects the dominant males that would otherwise be attacking them, but they present that colorful rear end, and that male's aggressive behavior is decreased. Hamsters do it. The female hamster has an odor that turns off the aggressive behavior of the female. It's not a visual stimulus, but an odor. So if I take a little of that odor on a Q-tip from the vaginal secretion of a female and put it on a male, that male is protected. Even if he was not a dominant male and he got beat up before by the males, now he's safe. And that's why these baboons and monkeys have evolved this. And he goes through another example. We'll probably return to some of that before. Only one more topic, really, the dummy rule. What is the dummy rule? It's not a dumb rule. It's the dummy rule. Okay, it's an ethological principle. Okay, read it and find out for the next class. You got to tell me what the dummy rule is and why it can't be inverted. Okay? And that answer, a full answer to that question will answer the last question also.